tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namasami. Again, in these series of talks during the Wassa, the rainy season retreat, I continued just to encourage the practice of quiet meditation and continue to give little tips, tricks, teachings in order to enhance one's meditation. All the theories of the world are useless if one hasn't got the power of the mind, which can actually see these things very clearly. That power of the mind is called mindfulness. It's something which we develop at each stage of this path of meditation. And when it gets very, very strong as a result of deep meditation, as a result of samadhi, then that mindfulness really becomes useful to us. That's where we see those great truths which the Buddha saw. We can really understand things like anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, non-self, suffering. And teachings like the one we've just chanted, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, just come alive with the power of that mindfulness, the mindfulness which is born of samadhi. But that mindfulness starts very early on in our life as a meditator to actually help to control, empower our practice of meditation. And you all know mindfulness very often when it's lacking, or rather you know that it was lacking, when sometimes you can waste time, waste hours, waste days, because you're not really putting the mind to the task. The mindfulness is one of the indriyas, one of the controlling faculties, the Buddha said, because this is what its purpose is, actually to guide the meditation. Always there as a gatekeeper, as a supervisor, always making sure that you're on the task. And this is the goal of mindfulness, to keep you on the straight and narrow, the eightfold path, the middle way. So you know that you're going in the right direction. You're not wasting time. Already over a month of this retreat has gone. And I'm constantly reminded by someone who rang up today, reminding me of the fourth anniversary of their father dying. It seemed like yesterday. Time just flows so fast. Before I know it, it'll be the end of this rains retreat. The end of your rains retreat. And you wonder how many more have you got left. So because of this, that we make sure that we have this idea of urgency, which empowers mindfulness, and mindfulness helps keep us on track. Sometimes, though, that people get confused that how can we have mindfulness and at the same time have this beautiful softness of the mind called non-doing or non-controlling. Surely that mindfulness is more doing, more controlling, more manipulating, more enforcing on the mind. And I've said many times, and I continue to say this, that it's that doer, that enforcer, that manager, that manipulator, which stops one gaining deep meditation, stops enjoying the fruits of meditation, not just the joy, but the insights and the freedom and the enlightenment which come as a result. So how can we sort of balance this idea of a controlling faculty with no control at all? And the point is here that we understand that mindfulness eventually becomes a natural protector of the mind's peacefulness. But before it comes that way, it needs to be developed, it needs to be focused on, it needs to be cultivated. And the ways we cultivate mindfulness are as follows. We don't cultivate mindfulness in the middle of the meditation. We cultivate it at the beginning. That's why in all the suttas you say the Anapanasati Sutta, you arouse mindfulness at the beginning before you even start watching the breath. If you try to arouse mindfulness in the middle, it's too disturbing, especially towards the end. Arise it at the beginning, which means at the very beginning of every meditation one almost checks this off. How mindful am I? How alert am I? But that's not just the end of mindfulness, just alertness. If you've heard me saying before, those of you who've heard me talk on mindfulness has another part to it, which too often people forget. and is probably forgetting the second part of mindfulness, which is one of the reasons why people don't gain success in meditation. One is the alertness, which I've already mentioned, the clarity of the mind, that faculty of mind which knows what you're doing, knows what's happening, knows the content of the present moment. The second part of mindfulness is that which remembers the instructions, which knows what it's supposed to be doing. Sometimes in the text that's called sampajanya. That's why it's so often that sati and sampajanya go together as a pair. Or like satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom go together as a pair. Really it's part of sati. Sati used to be just the tradition, the memory of the tradition. It was included, or rather the meaning of remembering the instructions, remembering the theory, was included in the basic meaning of mindfulness. Which means that when you start your meditation, you should not only arouse clarity of mind, alertness, but also to remind yourself of the instructions. In the next half hour, hour, however long you're going to sit, or however long you're walking, what are you supposed to be doing? What is the purpose of this? What are you going to follow in this meditation hour or session? You set up the instructions very clearly. If you're going to do breath meditation, you remember the steps of breath meditation. There's a in the Anapanasati Sutta, if you can't remember that, in things like my basic method of meditation booklet. You remember those instructions, get them clear in your mind before you begin. It's like before you set out on a journey, getting out the road map so you know which way to go. Otherwise you find you're going up from here to Armidale and you should be going down south to Mandurah before you start remembering what you're supposed to be doing. You waste time by not remembering the instructions. So you get those instructions clearly in mind. And part of those instructions, and this is a powerful part of mindfulness, is actually programming yourself. Programming yourself especially to avoid those hindrances which are your big obstacles. This is that old simile, that metaphor I have of the snake. This metaphor of the snake, I remind everybody, when I was in Thailand without any flashlight batteries, having to walk back from the evening talk through the jungle. Many monasteries I used to do this. Without any flashlight batteries, sometimes with no sandals, knowing there were snakes on the path. Just have to use starlight, or moonlight if you were lucky, to find your way. And every now and again you'd see a shape across the path. It was a snake. Could have been a twig, I don't know, but I saw that and I took evasive action. You'd only do that if you warned yourself before you set out on that journey back to your hut. Be careful, there are snakes on the path. Be on the lookout for them. Because I programmed my mind before I left the hall on my way back to my hut, that's why I saw those snakes and I never got bitten. In the very same way, whatever is your biggest problem in meditation, whether it's thinking too much, whether it's sloth and torpor, whether it's too much controlling, whether it's excitement when you get to the deep stages of meditation, whatever it is your problem at this particular time. Tell mindfulness what that problem is. Make it very clear to mindfulness, this is a problem, which is a snake which has bitten me so many times. Or like the python of sloth and torpor, which strangles you so you can't even see clearly. Whatever it is the problem, tell yourself at the beginning of your meditation and instruct your mind, or rather mindfulness. Mindfulness, be on the lookout. If you see sloth and torpor coming up, notice it. Take evasive action immediately. If you see too much controlling coming up, take evasive action. Let go. Relax. If there's excitement when the nimitta comes up, if that happens, mindfulness, now listen. Just be still. It's going well. Have confidence. It's okay. Do not get excited. Just be still and just watch. And if you program mindfulness clearly, I usually do this three times. I formulate some words, keep it as simple as possible, but as instructive as possible, in the same way that you'd be, you know, telling somebody sort of what you want from the shops this afternoon when somebody's going in. You give them clear instructions. I usually repeat those clear instructions three times to myself to make sure I hear it. In calmness, in stillness, say that to myself three times. And it's amazing just how effective it is. In meditating away, and then sloth and torpor starts to come, and something kicks in, this mindfulness, which says, sloth and torpor coming, sort of be more alert, you put more energy into the mindfulness, more joy or whatever, you avoid it. If it's like controlling, you get to a point, you've let go so far, and then you get a bit afraid and you start to control, mindfulness kicks in because you've told yourself. When you see the controller starting to get strong, shh, calm, calm, calm. And it happens naturally. If you watch very carefully, you don't do this. It's just cause and effect. You've conditioned mindfulness, and mindfulness remembers. This gets incredibly important towards the finer stages of meditation. Stages such as the nimitta coming up. Because there, you can't interrupt the process. If it's going wrong, it will go wrong. If you try and set it up right, you make it worse. Such a sensitive stage of the meditation that any intrusion will disturb everything. If the mind starts to move and you say, shut up, you've moved even more. Words even saying shut up is a movement which destroys everything. That's why very often when you get to those stages, there's a small tremble and it makes an avalanche, the whole thing just disappears. And very often you don't just go back to the previous stage. You go way back to the beginning sometimes. Simply because one movement creates another reaction, which creates a bigger reaction. You can't stop it. However, if you program the mind beforehand, you don't need to give instructions at that moment. Mind is prepared. Mindfulness is strong then. It knows exactly what to do. And mindfulness does it, not you. Fascinating to watch how the mind works and how will, choice, doing actually occurs. This is how to do without doing. Because all the doing is done at the beginning. Mindfulness is well instructed and knows exactly what to do at the right time and the right place. So in the deep states of meditation, you don't need to interrupt the process at all. You don't need to reprogram yourself. It's all on automatic, and it's programmed correctly. You just stand back, as it were, in your mind. You just watch without doing anything, and mindfulness does it all. It sees the snakes on the path, and very nimbly steps over them, or just goes on a slight detour, and passes all those obstacles which used to stop you before. This is what mindfulness does. So remember at the beginning of your meditation, you can save a lot of time in meditation and get so much deeper by programming mindfulness. And the other part of mindfulness, that alertness, that clarity of mind. You know, you've heard me say this before, but it needs to be emphasized, that mindfulness has different degrees. It's not just like being alert, because there are times when you're very brightly alert, supremely alert. Sometimes your alertness is just so sharp, better than it's ever been before. You can just see so deeply into the minutiae of anything. The mind is bright. And you'll always associate that brightness of mindfulness with happiness. And this is that insight which I keep pronouncing, that happiness is the power of the mind. Is the energy of the mind, and mindfulness needs that energy. If you're dull, you don't have much mindfulness at all. And sometimes you don't know you have no mindfulness, and mindfulness can't even see itself, doesn't know it's sort of weak. Because you're not mindful, very often you can misinterpret things very easily, like walking in the mist, you can trip over things, you can hit things. That's where we get upset at each other. We say rotten things to each other. We argue with each other. We insult each other because we've got a weak mind. But once the mindfulness starts to get empowered by happiness, by mental energy. It's just so hard to get upset because you have happiness instead. Happiness is a softness of the mind. Without that happiness, it's cold and brittle and just so easy to crack and to destroy. And it's just so soft. Sometimes it's so soft and fluffy, like a cloud. You can't hit a cloud. You can't strike it. You can't make any noise when you slap it, because it gives in every direction. That's what the mind, which is empowered by energy, by happiness, by strong mindfulness, is. So you know, as well as instructing mindfulness, our job is to empower mindfulness. And we empower mindfulness through happiness, which is why that during our day it's important to cultivate happiness. Which is why I keep telling many people to please cultivate playtime. If you work too hard on your meditation, you'll find you'll get tight. Even the Buddha said in the Anguttara Nikaya, if you're giving a lot of time to the practice of samadhi, you should also give practice to one, arousing effort, and also to equanimity practice as well. Just to be at peace from time to time. Equanimity I call playtime. Where you're just at peace with things. You're resting. You're not working hard at all. And arousing energy is those things which arouse happiness for you. The mental energy, whether it's reading a sutta, whether it's going for a walk in the forest, whether it's whatever it is which you find gives joy. One of the best ways of developing joy, which especially you senior monks can do, is recollecting, you know, all of your good qualities. All the things which you've given to the Sangha, to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha over the years, all the services which you've done, is called Chaganasati. And that's one of my practices. Sometimes I give so much to others, but really I get so much back once I start reflecting on what I've done. Reflect on what I've done, how much I've given. And you couldn't believe how much piti sukha that brings up. That's mental energy. With that degree of mental energy, all the mindfulness is just so strong. And that mindfulness is so strong, it looks on all I've given again, all the good karma I've done, and it gets even more blissful. And you get this snowball effect. Once you get into it, you just reflect on all the things which you've given. You've given up. You've given for the Buddhist Society, Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, Buddhist Gem Fellowship in Malaysia, here, there and everywhere. My goodness, that's a huge store of merit. And all you need to do is to reflect on it. And you get these huge waves of piti sukha coming up. Each one of you, you've worked in a good monastery. You've cooked, you've cleaned, you've given dana, you've helped monks. It's huge amounts of good karma you've done. And this is no exaggeration. It's actually quite putting it down by saying it's huge. It's enormous. And all you need to do is to tap into that by reflecting on it. What you're doing, just practicing in a good monastery where you're keeping your precepts, you're practicing compassion, you're practicing loving kindness, meditation, you're becoming wise, you're doing the Buddha's job. That's huge karma, good karma, brilliant karma. You should delight in that. If you delight in it, energy starts coming into the mind. Mindfulness starts to get strong. Happiness comes. It's one of the ways of developing the happy states. Chaganusati. As is developing the recollections of the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. In your heart, you can chant if you like it tippy so. When you chant, chant slowly. Remember what those words mean. Or just think of the Buddha statue on your wall. Think of the Dhamma you've learnt. Think of all the great monks and nuns, the Sangha over the centuries, who have sat in the same mental states as you have sat, who've worked, developed, and are now no more because parinibbana. They felt just like you felt. They experienced the same hindrances as you've experienced. You can read about those hindrances in the text. As they are, you will be. It's amazing sort of inspiration which you can have. When you start reflecting in this way on the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, again you get huge amounts of energy, mental energy, happiness. You're reflecting wisely, reflecting in a way which increases mindfulness, which empowers it. That's why the Buddha actually encouraged his cousin Mahanama, who wanted to develop these jhanas and hadn't done so yet. He encouraged him to develop the jhanas by doing the recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. It's amazing advice from the Buddha. Didn't say just get right into Anapanasati. Do Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha recollections first of all. You can understand why that advice was given. You needed to empower mindfulness first. Otherwise, you just go into Anapanasati, just watching the breath and get nowhere. Just get lost, watching the breath for a few minutes and then the mind just drifts off, or thinking, or fantasizing, or going to sleep, or whatever. It wouldn't work. Why? Because mindfulness was not strong enough yet. So you need to empower the mind, first of all. Also, one of my other favorite reflections is actually the reflections of the holy places in India. I must admit I really get off on those. By getting off on them, whenever I recollect them, it's just instant store of energy. It's like instant coffee, only much better. And you don't need to get hot water or mix it up. Just need to remember, recall. There's amazing places where you've been in India, where you've sat where the Buddha sat. You've walked where the Buddha walked. It's an amazing opportunity to chant Napatimokkha at Lumbini, where the Buddha was born. Oh, that was a high. I love that so much. I'm just recollecting it, just thinking about it now. If I open my eyelids, you see it's all wet underneath. Piti Sukha coming up, energy, mind energy. And that mind energy means the mindfulness is so strong, so powerful. What it sees very clearly. It doesn't mistake things. It's bright and it's alert, it's shined up, it's empowered. You've turned up the wattage of your mindfulness and it sees so deeply, so clearly. So by developing the happiness, you're empowering mindfulness. Its quality starts to get very, very strong. So when you start watching the breath, it's easy to watch the breath. If you do loving kindness, oh, it's so nice. If you want to do kasinas, the beautiful discs, you've got such mindfulness, so strong, that the mind will delight in whatever it watches. It's got the natural happiness. When I say we put happiness into things, this is how we do it. We're putting mindfulness into what we're doing. Because that mindfulness, the quality, the strength of it, is measured by the happiness in the mind. Once you start to do this, you start watching the breath going in. First of all, you just see the whole breath very clearly, and you're enjoying it. It's happy. Because the mind is powerful. Sometimes this happens naturally to monks or novices, anagarikas, they're sitting there. It's so easy to watch the breath or, you know, do loving kindness or whatever else you're doing. It's just so easy to do. Always notice because you're happy. The mind is bright. You're enjoying it. It's just such an easy thing to do. Understand that the mindfulness is strong. It's got high quality mindfulness, suitable for doing the task. You don't build up that mindfulness first of all, sometimes you're just wasting your time. So if the mind is dull, if mindfulness is wandering all over the place, then perhaps it's a good thing to do. Recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Recollection of Chaga. All of the goodness which you've done in the world. And then you get bright. Mindfulness starts to develop and get strong. And you just watch the breath, it's so easy to do. And as you're watching the breath, you'll notice something happening. Because you're focusing mindfulness now. It's not just on Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. It's on just this beautiful breath. It becomes beautiful, it looks beautiful, because of the quality of the mindfulness. Sometimes it's not all that beautiful at the beginning, but if you start having powerful mindfulness, it soon becomes incredibly beautiful. The beauty of the breath is measured by the amount of mindfulness you have. When the mindfulness is strong, this is what the breath looks like. In many experiences in my life, just mindfulness gets so strong, you can look on a piece of shit and it looks amazingly beautiful. You wouldn't believe it, what the mind can do. Because it's just so powerful, and it's fascinated. And just the life looks just amazingly wonderful. A leaf on a tree, just the moon coming up in the evening. The full moon was coming up as we came in here. It's the way that just it works with the clouds. It's wonderful, beautiful. Even as you find, it's a strange thing I told somebody, as you meditate, you become more mindful. The food becomes more delicious. Because you can taste more of it, basically. You go into it more. Whatever you do becomes beautiful. It's a strange thing. Here you are, you're trying to get rid of sort of, you know, attachments, and people think you're having a hard time. Because mindfulness starts to go strong, the whole monastery just glows. Your huts just glow. Just the whole world is just, oh, this is so nice. Especially inside. Just one breath becomes the most delicious, beautiful thing in the whole world. Now, can you understand how samadhi happens? The mindfulness and samadhi go hand in hand. As the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, as it gets more and more focused, and you get this big build-up of bliss. It's a bliss snowball. And once you get to that stage, you just lay back or sit back or whatever you're doing and just go along for the ride. Sometimes you just can't stop it. Mindfulness is just so sharp, so powerful, it just sees so deeply into the breath. It sees right into the center of the breath, like a microscope. And as it sees right into the center of the breath, just things just fall away. Worlds just disappear. The world of edges goes. You've just got centers, centers, centers. The world of doing just disappears because you can't control this. It's all natural. The power, the mindfulness, the mind, the natural process just takes over. This natural process which you see in the suttas. Now once you get piti coming up, you don't need to think, you don't need to plan. Oh, may my body be tranquil. It happens naturally. When your body becomes tranquil, you don't have to think, well, my mind becomes tranquil. It happens naturally. When the mind becomes tranquil, you don't have to think, might get sukha up. It happens naturally. When you have got sukha coming up with beautiful nimittas, you don't have to think, oh, may I enter samadhi. It happens naturally. It's tamachata, as they say in the sutta. It's Anguttara Nikaya somewhere, I forget what it's called. In the translation which I've got in this book by Aronson or something, it's enlightenment is a natural process. It's a beautiful sutta. It just shows that you're not involved at all. You just completely sit back and go along for the ride. It just takes over. Power mindfulness, bliss. That's what mindfulness means. It's not an ordinary thing. It's not just sitting here being mindful. It's something which is cultivated. First by giving instructions, then by empowering it with happiness by these reflections. You really get into it. And the mindfulness gets incredibly strong when you're in jhanas. Even when you're in nimittas, the mindfulness should be pretty strong. If it ain't strong, it means you didn't sort of put enough happiness in the beginning. Sometimes nimittas come up and they're just dull. That's your fault. You didn't put enough happiness in. Mindfulness is not strong. The mind is not bright. What you're seeing there is a reflection of your mind. Reflection of the person is, or not the person, reflection of the thing which is looking. Nimittas is the mind looking in a mirror, seeing itself. Next time, if you want a much brighter nimitta, the brilliant ones, the ones which are a billion times brighter than the sun, start getting some happiness going. Reflect on your holy places you've been to. Your favorite chants. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Great Aryans you've known. Wow. Start really getting into it. Into it and more into it. And then you just go and watch the breath. When nimitta comes up, they're guaranteed. That's a powerful one. Huge one. Remember, just one of the stories once, the dreams of getting nimittas in your dream. I told this, I think, to Ajahn Yan. I don't know if I told it to many other people, but I started, now I can't stop. It's in a dream, just going past, we're walking with Ajahn Yan, all these shrines of the Kubar Ajahns. And Ajahn, I wanted to linger, because just to get off on these great monks I've known, that I've stayed with, talked to. And I think it was this shrine of Ajahn Tate, and there's a little picture on his shrine. And as soon as I looked upon the picture, just so much piti sukha came up, this amazing nimitta came up, which just blasted me. Oh, that was nice. It really was. It was beautiful. This huge light just envelops you. And this is just the joy, the happiness that's made my mindfulness so strong. And this is actually what you do. The nimittas which come up when you've empowered the mind are just the most amazing things. They're powerful enough to take you into the jhanas. And when they take you into the jhanas, then you start to know what mindfulness can do. That's really strong. Sometimes people think that in the jhanas you've got not much mindfulness, that you're sort of like dull, like in a bhavanga state, where there's no mindfulness at all. And that's anyone who says that doesn't know what jhanas are. These are states of supreme mindfulness. And it says in the suttas that the purity, the extreme of mindfulness comes in fourth jhana. That's where mindfulness reaches its absolute peak. You're the most mindful you've ever been. You don't know what mindfulness actually is. Before, you've just been scratching surfaces. Just seeing the old bombs of cars. You haven't been into the showroom of the most exquisite models. Once you see those exquisite models of what mindfulness can be, they're amazing. So powerful, so wonderful, so beautiful to behold. The mindfulness gets stronger and stronger. In this stage, you don't need any instructions anymore. Gatekeepers are just left behind a long time ago. Just all natural process, going deeper and deeper. And when you come out from those deep meditation states, the stillness is gone. The lack of things like will and senses, that's disappeared. You've got senses, the mind can move again now. You can hear, you can smell. If you open your eyes, you could see. The mind can move. You've got this incredibly powerful mindfulness left. That's what you use to find out your past lives. That's what you use to find out the nature of this thing called the mind. You don't try and find this out by talking about it, by reading books, nor even by asking Kubar Ajahns. Is there an original mind or not an original mind? Really, just I'm a bit stupid even for talking about that as well. Get those jhanas. Get that powerful mindfulness, huge powerful mindfulness, and then find out for yourself. It should be as obvious, as they say, as a nose on your face. Find out for yourself. With that degree of mindfulness, it just penetrates in. Whatever it looks at, it's amazing what it can do. If you want to send loving kindness to somebody who's died, then you can do that. You can blast them. This is what I keep saying. Zap them. Just like some superhero in the movies. Because that's what you are. You're a superhero of meditation. These wonderful beings, the Uttarimurusadhammas, the superhuman attainments. You can do such amazing things, blast them with loving kindness. Then you can really do something to help. Or instead of blasting a person with loving kindness, you can blast your defilements, your delusions, with the amazing power of mind called mindfulness. So strong. You just look at the mind. What is it? Look at the five khandhas. What are these things? Khandhas. Body, Vedana, Sanya, perception, sankharas, all this mental formation. What is thought anyway? Where does it come from? Whose is it? You can just blast it apart with powerful mindfulness. You can see right into it. What are these sankharas? Blast apart vijnana, consciousness, to see with this amazing, powerful mind. That's what mindfulness really is. When you notice how powerful that mindfulness can be, then you notice what the Buddha meant by this, and just how it's part of the controlling faculties, and also how it's part of the enlightenment factors. First of the enlightenment factors is sati sambhojanga. But it doesn't mean ordinary sati, it means the sati, what it says is viveka nisita, which is resting on, dependent upon, I'd say even like created upon, seclusion, the seclusion of the mind, which ripens, as they say, parinama, or turns into wosaga, into relinquishing, giving up. When that mindfulness is so strong, she sees these things, vaporizes them, so they're no longer there anymore. You see that this connection between the idea of a self and these five khandhas, five khandhas encompass everything. Six ayatanas, six senses. Everything you see with just this powerful mindfulness. And you realize just how useless it is to think when you haven't got this deep mindfulness. How useless it is even to argue and debate. Even how useless it is to actually to ask questions of people. All they can do is just like encourage you to find out for yourself. And this is what you do need to do. Pachatang vedutabho vinyuhi. Each wise person to see them for themselves, what the Dhamma is, what the truth is. Which is why in this monastery, that sometimes I know I've been criticized here, don't teach insight. I teach the way to insight. Empowering the mind so you can see. Giving you eyes, giving you mindfulness, giving you power. That's why we meditate in this way. So please remember whenever you start meditating to bring up first of all the instructions, remind yourself. After the instructions, empower the mind with happiness. Don't work too hard, not too soft, whatever makes the mind powerful. Ill will saps energy for mindfulness. It weakens it. If you get beat up on yourself or beat up on others, this person's fault, that person's fault, you're upset, you're angry, you're just draining the energies from your mind. Craving, fantasies, lust, they also drain the energies from the mind. Sometimes you look at these Kubo Ajahns, you know, people like Ajahn Pliyan, how on earth does he have so much energy? And that guy is amazing. Sorry, I shouldn't say that guy. That great monk is amazing. Where does he get all that energy from? In this talk you've heard where the energy comes from. Power mindfulness. Sometimes your mindfulness gets so strong you can't sleep at night. Great, you don't need to sleep. Only the sort of dull people, the lazy ones, need to sleep. As all the Kubo Ajahns say, when you die you can sleep as long as you like in your coffin. Now's the time to develop the loving kindness, the energy, the power mindfulness, the deep states of meditation. See the Dhamma for yourself. Seeing the Dhamma for yourself is such a happy path, such a beautiful experience. You get so much energy, so much insight, so much peace. You're really touching things which are at the depth and the same time the height of spiritual practices. So develop that mindfulness, empower it with happiness. Remember what you're supposed to be doing, and you find this path is both easy, it is fast, and it's incredibly good fun. So it's a little talk this evening on empowering mindfulness, what it is and how it's used.